Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to A Real World of Approach to Treating Tobacco Use in Mental Health Settings conference call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Ann Winland. Ms. Winland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Amanda. Good afternoon. This is Ann Winland, the Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I would like to welcome you to today's call, A Real World Approach to Treating Tobacco Use in Mental Health Settings. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Jill Williams, who is an Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Director of the Division of Addiction Psychiatry at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. On today's call, Dr. Williams will discuss a wellness-based group approach to tobacco dependence treatment that includes identifying challenges for group leaders in presenting information to mental health consumers and strategies for teaching smokers with mental illness about the consequences of smoking. I just want to remind you that you can access Dr. Williams' PowerPoint on the call registration page of nysmokefree.com. If you go to the front page of nysmokefree.com, go to the tab for healthcare providers, collaborative calls, you'll see an item for you to click and access the PowerPoint. Before we start, I have some housekeeping items. We're pleased to offer continuing education hours, including CMEs, CE, and KSET credit. To fulfill the requirement of continuing education, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Williams has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation. Her presentation is free from commercial bias or financial interests. Dr. Williams has received grant support from the National Institute of Drug Abuse and the National Institute of Mental Health and from Pfizer. She is a Pfizer Advisory Board member. To obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. Please remember applications for the credit will not be accepted after February 15th. That is 1 week from today. So please be sure to submit your application as soon as possible to receive the credit. Now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to Dr. Jill Williams. Dr. Williams?
Thank you, and good morning to everyone. It's exciting to be able to speak to you this morning about learning about Healthy Living Treatment Manual, which we developed several years ago. And hopefully you have been able to also access and maybe even download the manual, because I think if you, it is free on the web, and if you have it in front of you, I think it'll even make the training more helpful to be able to reference it as we go through the material. So I'm just going through my slides. My disclosures statement was already mentioned, and I'm not going to, I'm going to skip the objective slide. So many of you, I'm sure, already know that smokers with mental illness or substance use disorders are of increasing interest, and there are theories that these have really emerged as a large percentage of the remaining smokers in this country. In fact, data from Karen Lasser's study would indicate that three-fourths of cigarette smokers have a past or present problem with mental illness or addiction. Again, underscoring that this is a significant group of smokers that we're talking about that may need some unique strategies. So we know from addiction treatment that it makes sense to try to match treatment strategies to patients' motivational level. And so an important part of assessment of any tobacco user would be to understand the stages of change and therefore be able to match treatment strategies based on client stages of change. So I know you're all familiar with Prochaska and DiClemente's stages of change. And for the most part, this is a treatment that's really targeting people who are not in preparation, which is in contrast, really, to other tobacco treatment strategies. So traditionally, when people have thought about treating tobacco, or use the term cessation, which is quitting, it really implies an action-oriented approach. So clearly those types of treatment strategies are targeting people who are in the preparation stage. In contrast, people with serious mental illness or types of comorbidities who may not be motivated and may not be in preparation would more likely be in contemplation and pre-contemplation. And therefore, it's important to have strategies to work with these smokers who are not in preparation. In thinking about the goals of motivational interviewing, or the goals really of any motivational approach, the idea is that we're helping people who are in pre-contemplation through our counseling strategies to move to contemplation. And an example of that would be, in terms of a clinical scenario, that a patient who's very resistant and says that there's no chance of them ever stopping tobacco, if through your counseling strategy, and this could be over a period of several months or even longer, but suppose that client goes from saying, I'll never stop, I'm very resistant, I don't even want to talk about it, saying, you know, I recognize that this is a problem. I'm not ready to stop today, but I'm more willing to talk about it, and therefore you sense ambivalence on the part of the client. That patient has shown you that they've actually moved from pre-contemplation to contemplation. And in terms of the MI counseling strategies, that's really evidence of success. So we have to remember that when we're counseling people with the motivational strategies, and similarly, we could think about scenarios where we're helping people move from contemplation to actually taking steps forward into preparation, that this is really a success. This is evidence of a successful counseling intervention. And what's unfortunate about it, even though it's a success, is that you can't count this success in how many people quit, because, in fact, these may all represent people who continue to smoke, but they're still showing evidence of change in terms of their stage of change and readiness to eventually quit. So just to keep in mind that these counseling strategies are evidence of success and are worth doing, even though we may not be able to count our success in terms of how many people quit smoking, at least in the short term. And language is very important. We know that in terms of motivational techniques. And that's why we really recommend use of terminology like tobacco dependence treatment. It's just vague enough in a positive way to work and really be an umbrella encompassing so many aspects of what we do. And that's a preferred term compared to terms like smoking cessation, quitting, stopping, ending, which all really imply that they're targeting an action-oriented client. When we're working with clients with a range of motivational levels, it's important to not turn people off with these subtle word choices and make sure that we're inviting everyone to participate in our tobacco dependence treatment. The evidence in terms of the research is a little bit mixed with regard to motivational levels in these smokers. There's some evidence that their motivation is no different than other smokers, and some evidence that they may have lower motivation than other smokers. So there is a little bit of mixed information here, but I still think it's important that we emphasize a need to increase motivational levels in clients before tobacco treatment can begin, which is the main point. When we introduce this concept to mental health treatment programs, we try to tell them if they're embracing treating tobacco for the first time, that one way to approach it is to think about integrating it into their models for complete wellness. Many of these sites have initiatives and programs about wellness and recovery. There's a large movement in this country to embrace wellness and recovery in substance abuse and mental health treatment, yet ironically, these models often don't include addressing tobacco. So for places that have wellness curricula, wellness classes, wellness initiatives. Sometimes that's a nice way to begin to introduce the concept of addressing tobacco. And certainly it's part of our model for complete wellness. So with that background in mind, in terms of motivational approaches and wellness, we were approached by the state of New Jersey to develop a treatment which we would develop to specifically work with smokers with mental illness who might not be motivated to address their smoking. So that was our charge when we set out to develop this manual. The state wanted the manual to be extremely easy to use and implement for community mental health settings that had really no prior tobacco experience. We went with a group format because we felt that would be the most feasible for these settings. And we designed the manual, although it has the majority of content is about tobacco, it was framed as a healthy living manual on purpose. So some of it includes topics on healthy eating, increasing physical activity, in addition to tobacco, so that we could frame the whole package as healthy living, even though the focus is on tobacco. And that was done very much on purpose, again, so that we could be inviting to as many clients as possible. So you see, we named our manual Learning About Healthy Living, as opposed to Let's All Go to Tobacco Group, which was very much on purpose, again, to use language, be very welcoming and inviting to everyone, and not put the focus initially on tobacco, recognizing that the population may not be motivated at this time to address tobacco. And it was certainly a collaborative effort of many authors that you can see here, and it's available on the Internet for download, as I mentioned. So Learning About Healthy Living was a collaborative project between several schools in our university and funded by the New Jersey Division of Mental Health Services. The manual was designed for several reasons. We wanted the manual to give information about the recovery process from tobacco addiction and to help to motivate the audience so that by learning about tobacco, they would become motivated try to take steps to change this behavior. It includes information about psychiatric symptoms in addition to tobacco and how they might be related. We emphasize the other reason to include skills like healthy living, dealing with stress, and healthy eating was to help people to learn some new skills that might also support them when they were ready to quit smoking. There's some aspects of relapse prevention that are included in the manual in terms of understanding your triggers and avoiding them when you're ready to stop smoking. And then certainly to use the group format, not only is group feasible in a lot of mental health settings, but it also has some additional advantages. Group provides additional support and modeling, which is very important in this group of clients. It's very exciting in groups like these when someone starts to change their behavior or even tries to quit smoking. There can be kind of a contagion that takes place and is very motivating for other group members to see people starting to succeed. Remember, in this group of clients, they may not have many experiences in terms of seeing other people to successfully quit. So that we thought that would be an important thing we would want them to experience. I'm referring to the Learning About Healthy Living group. Most of the time I'm referring to group one, but in fact, when you look in the manual, you'll see that there's actually two group curricula contained in the manual. Group one is called the Learning About Healthy Living group. Group two is much more of a traditional quitting smoking type group. And the manual was designed so that if clients participated in group one and they actually became motivated in changing their behavior or trying to stop smoking, the idea was that they could essentially graduate to group two, which would be an action-oriented quit smoking group. But for the most part, for our discussion today, I'll be referring to group one. The manual was designed with a facilitator's guide. So each week of group, we call a chapter, and each chapter contains information for consumers, for smokers, with a handout. And then there's a facilitator's guide that corresponds. So each week of the manual, each week of group, there's a brief orientation to the facilitator. It explains to the facilitator, these are the objectives for this week's group. These are some things you might want to try in group. If you wanted to seek out additional resources or references, those are included. And as you look at the facilitator's guide, you'll see that we tried to keep it quite short so that the information was practical. It's often presented in bullets because we know sometimes you're reading this on the way to group. So that it's handy information, but also very brief and focused. This picture shows the orientation of the group, and if you're following along, I'm on slide 18. This is the way the manual is organized into eight chapters. So I'll say something about each of the chapters of the book. Chapters 1 and 2, and actually chapter 3, are introductory information. Chapter 1 is similar to some of the information I'm sharing with you right now on this webinar. Chapter 2 is just background information about organizing and running a group. Chapter 3 is a background chapter that has some brief review for the facilitator on tobacco treatment medications. Although keep in mind, as you can see, this was last revised in 2005, so it does predate the development of Chantix. Chapter 4 and Chapter 5 are Group 1, and you can see there's the consumer handouts in Chapter 5 and the corresponding facilitator's guide in Chapter 4, and similarly Chapter 7 and 8 you can see are for Group 2. So Group 1 is essentially a 20-week curriculum. The sessions are educational and motivational. The idea when we wrote the manual is that we would accept essentially all smokers with serious mental illness, so there's no entry criteria. Anybody who smokes should be able to participate. We piloted the manual in several outpatient settings in New Jersey. And we talked about how the curriculum is mainly about smoking, but it's in the context of healthy living. So there are topics, in addition to tobacco, a few of them interspersed on exercise, stress, and diet. People have asked about, you know, what can I use the manual in a more flexible way? Can I rearrange the order of the sessions? Can I spend more than a week on each session? Can I spend less than a week on each session? And I would say, yeah, do what you need to do to make it work for your setting. People have used it in hospital settings where they've modified it to deliver some of the material in less than 20 weeks, etc. One thing, though, that I would be mindful of is in the organization of the different sessions. So this is the table of contents for group one, and you can see the list, the title of each session really describes the content of that week's session. And we did put this together in a very deliberate way. So I think scrambling up the sessions might be not so helpful. If you look, and we spend a few minutes on this table of contents, I just wanted to share with you our understanding and how we put some of these sessions together. So you can see the first few sessions, the titles sound very inviting. Welcome to the Healthy Living Group. Starting on the road to healthy living. There's nothing about stopping, quitting, ending, changing behavior, because the thought is that if you're bringing in people with contemplation or pre-contemplation who are not ready to take any active steps, that you'll certainly turn them off by using action language. So we're really just there to kind of welcome people, come along for the ride. You don't need to do anything. You're just here to listen and learn. And similarly, the first few topics really don't focus much on the individual. Just learning some general information, what's in smoke. Perhaps at week 5, the topic is what is carbon monoxide. That would be a time we might introduce the carbon monoxide meter, talk about carbon monoxide for that week session, take a reading from everybody. And that's really the first time that there's any kind of personal information that you're asking consumers to share, and that's already 5 weeks in. If you scan down, you'll see the quit word isn't even introduced until week 15. Again, that's on purpose. We're trying to work with people and gain their buy-in and trust and build the relationship before we talk about why should I even think about quitting. We're afraid if we introduce it too early, again, we'll scare people off. They might not return. So it starts, the group intentionally starts in kind of a very general way. By about week 11, you can see what are my smoking patterns. We hope the person can begin to focus maybe on their own behavior, at least in a reflective way. What's my behavior like? And then maybe by week 15, you know, why should I even think about quitting? Is it possible for me to quit? What we hope happens by the end of 20 weeks is that they have become more motivated. They are thinking about what would come next after this group. What would happen if I was thinking about trying to quit? And so at that point, the group really focuses in on what the next steps would be. What would it be like to quit? How would I quit successfully? And you can see that there's several weeks discussion about how can I use medication to help me to successfully quit smoking, thinking that the person is now transitioning to get ready for a more action-oriented approach. So that's the thinking behind the 20 sessions. In terms of the therapist style of delivering treatment, it's kind of a mixed approach. Each of the handouts, as we see when we go through them, does have some educational content, so there would be certainly some sharing information in the group. However, I would strongly advise you not to do a classroom style setup. It really is meant to be more of a process group where people might be sitting in a circle and facing each other. So it's a combination of kind of checking in with clients, talking about smoking in a supportive way, and also being kind of a coach facilitator, educational and motivational, a little bit of everything. And also this group goes at a fairly slow pace, so there's lots of time for repetition and to assess comprehension to make sure that people are getting the content. You could review it, you know, from the week before, et cetera. But it's really a hybrid of an educational and process group. And now I'll show you some of the actual pages from the manual. Again, I hope you have some of this in front of you, because I think it'll make it more meaningful for you, and then we can talk about some questions at the end. This is an example. This is page 24 from the manual, and this is an example of a facilitator, a page from the facilitator's guide. So this is for you, for your content. It's telling you what are your objectives for this week's group, what are you hoping to accomplish in the group, and then some ideas about suggested approach. You know, try to get everybody talking, allow people to introduce themselves. A lot of this is kind of common sense. But it helps you to focus on specific goals for each session. If we go to the next page, you can see this is the first session of the group, and this is an example of the consumer's handout. We try to have pictures and have it be kind of inviting for people. There's fairly big font. We've tried to keep it at sixth grade reading level. So you can see this is kind of week one, starting on the road to healthy living. Healthy living helps us. We feel good physically. Congratulations. We're so glad you're here. So again, nothing about having to change anything. Just coming is good enough. This is actually, the next page is the back of that handout. So you might just do a brief assessment here with the clients in the group. How much do you smoke? How interested are you in learning about smoking? So just kind of beginning the discussion. Week 2, Chapter 2, you see here the topic is why is smoking dangerous? So just sharing some basic public health information with this group that may not be aware of some of the risks of smoking. They may not have benefited from some of the public health messages that the rest of us benefit from. Reinforcing and reminding people tobacco addiction is the most common addiction in the United States. It's also the most common addiction among people with mental illness. The next page is Chapter 3. And Chapter 3 is really a fun chapter. I think this the feedback we've gotten from people who have implemented the group is that consumers generally like Week 3. This is a time when energy goes up in group and people seem to become more animated and participate in the discussion. And this is when we introduce to consumers, you know, that there's thousands of chemicals in cigarette smoke. It's not an agricultural product. Lots of things cause cancer, and these are some of the toxic chemicals contained in cigarette smoke. And, of course, when you have pictures, it makes it so much more meaningful compared to when you just have text. And if you were to read the facilitator's guide for this session, it explains, again, the objectives, what you'd like to discuss, talk about, what are you surprised to learn is found in cigarette smoke. But then there's also additional ideas. So if you're the counselor that really goes above and beyond and wants to do extra, you might even bring in a box of some of the empty bottles to, again, give a visual presentation of this information. You know, this is nail polish remover or battery acid or carpet cleaner, and to show people, you know, these toxic chemicals are what's contained in cigarette smoke. So there's ways you can really have a lot of fun with this in terms of sharing the information with the group. As I mentioned, in week 5, we typically bring in the carbon monoxide meter. We have the discussion about carbon monoxide. And remember, although you all are well-versed in some of this content, for a mental health worker who might be doing tobacco for the first time, one of the reasons I think that they like using this manual is because the content is included right on the handout, so there's not a lot that they have to remember. As long as you're bringing the handouts every week, it kind of tells you what's important about carbon monoxide, the good news, the bad news, how it hurts your body. So I think for someone implementing this for the first time, it's fairly straightforward because the information is contained on the handout. It's not always possible to show you in these slides, but the way that these lessons are organized is that the first page that I'm typically showing you is the content. And the back of these pages is often an exercise, fill in the blank, a question for discussion. So you have the option of bringing pencils to the group and having people fill them out, respond to the questions, or doing them in a more discussion-oriented way. But there's an activity like that, or two or three, in fact, for each week session, again, so that people are talking. It's more discussion format, getting people thinking about the implication of the material, and you're not just lecturing to the group, which I think would be a mistake in most cases. So this is Chapter 6, how much does smoking cost? We found in our work that people are very, price and financial aspects of smoking can be a very strong motivator, and it's remarkable sometimes that people don't recognize how much they're spending on tobacco over a week or a month or a year or even a lifetime. And so we have a discussion about that and do some calculations with people. And also in terms of goal setting, these are people that are on a very low income who can't afford some basic things. And so to say that by quitting smoking you could buy some new clothes or afford to go out to dinner or out to lunch once a week, that's a goal that can be really meaningful for people in thinking about how they might spend that tobacco money in a different way. And again, that can be very motivating to people. Chapter 8, we're talking about secondhand smoke, so what's the effect of your smoke on other people in your environment? Again, our studies have found that a lot of this population, more than 60%, will tell us that they smoke inside or that they live with other smokers. So they seem to be not aware of the potential effect of smoke on others in the environment, whether that's family, friends, their case manager, their pets. So this is an important discussion to have. Even if these people never stop smoking, they should be encouraged to smoke outdoors, and they have to understand the risk of their smoke on others in the environment. So you can see up until now, there's really no talk about quitting. It's really just about gaining information and knowledge, and hopefully people are becoming motivated. This is week 10, a discussion about addiction. Are cigarettes addicting? Are you addicted? Take the quiz. You know, how many minutes in the morning till you smoke your first cigarette? So again, beginning to think about what's this personally mean to me? What's my behavior? If I'm addicted, you know, does that mean something? Do I want to change that? But you can see it took us several weeks to get to this point. Similarly, Chapter 11, again, more detail. What's my behavior? Where do I smoke? When do I smoke? Are there common scenarios? Are there triggers? So just more like identifying behavior. You can see, again, as I mentioned, there's a few other interspersed chapters. So how can I manage stress? If people say that they have to smoke because they are stressed out and they don't have another way to deal with stress, this is a nice way to talk about practicing deep breathing or thinking about other skills that might help you to deal with stress in a better way. Similarly, we have this topic on physical activity. And again, we tend to use physical activity as opposed to exercise in working with this population, because for some people, just getting out of the chair and doing a little bit of walking can really not only give them tremendous benefit, but can be evidence of a tremendous behavior change. So we're not talking about cardio in the gym. We're talking about, you know, can you take the stairs? Are there small changes that you can make that would help you to be more active and more healthy? And you can see we follow that up in Chapter 14 and just some introduction to also thinking about healthy food. In Chapter 15, when we hope now we've had some trust and buy-in from consumers, they're coming back to group, they're learning a lot about their smoking. We hope that at this point maybe they've gone from pre-contemplation to contemplation, where they're not so actively opposed to changing this behavior. They're interested in learning more about it, even though they haven't taken any steps forward. And we know that when someone's in contemplation, one of the strategies that can work when someone's ambivalent is to do a decisional balance. So that's why we introduce it at this point, because we're hoping that the person perhaps is now in contemplation, where one of the useful steps can be to think about, you know, things that would be good about quitting smoking, reasons to keep smoking, and trying to change that balance over time more towards making the decision to quit. We follow that up the next week with what if I'm not ready to quit. So it's always of concern to me that once we begin to introduce the Q word that we lose people, and that's always my worry. And it's hard to know how to balance this in a way that we don't lose the people who are not so motivated. So, you know, we wanted to actually make a whole session about, you know, we know it's okay that you may be ambivalent. You might not be ready, although your neighbor's ready, and you shouldn't feel bad about that. It's not a negative. We still want you to come to group and participate in this program, and it's normal to have mixed feelings. So to kind of acknowledge some of the ambivalence and to encourage people to not drop out, even if they're not feeling ready to change. And then, as I mentioned, the last four groups really do focus in on people who might be ready to take the next step. So is it possible for me to quit? And if it were possible, what would I need to do as the next step? So Chapter 18 is very important to educate this group of clients because, in fact, these clients will tell you that they're trying to stop smoking all the time. So it's not that they don't make quit attempts. They just make very unsuccessful ones. And one of the reasons is because they're not quitting with treatment. They're just impulsively getting up one day and saying, I'm going to try to stop smoking. So very few of those quit attempts make it to 24 hours. I really educate this group of clients that cold turkey is bad, that we don't want them to just keep waking up and trying to quit, that there's a different way to go, that the message is to quit with treatment, and that that will help them to be more successful. So again, spending some time talking about withdrawal, saying that, you know, we don't want you to suffer, we want you to succeed, and the missing step may be that you didn't really have access to treatment. Similarly, then, in chapters 19 and 20, there's information about, you know, what are the medications that I could use to help me to quit smoking? How would I use them? How do I know which one is right for me? And you can see here, unfortunately, it doesn't include Chantix, although you could kind of write that in, I guess, so that you have a more thorough discussion. But there's a little bit of kind of review information for consumers about the different nicotine medicines, about the fact that bupropion is a pill, and just some basic information that they might want to know about using those medications and, you know, encouraging them to also talk to their doctor so that they could take the next step. Finally, in the manual, the last chapter, Chapter 8, contains additional information and resources. And some of the resources that are contained in Chapter 8 are some sample forms that you might find useful. So we include here, you can see, some assessment forms, a sample treatment plan, instructions for how to do carbon monoxide monitoring, and some other sample handouts, in addition to references and other resources. Consumer self-report tobacco assessment is included here. It's an abbreviated form of an assessment that we might administer to a client, so it's a simplified version. People have asked me and said, well, shouldn't we assess everybody before we start group? And I think ideally the answer would be yes. We'd want to do at least a brief individual assessment with every client prior to bringing them into group. Wrote this form in a way that maybe some consumers could self-administer it so that they could take 15 minutes and fill it out for themselves. But there might be consumers for whom you would want to sit and help them to fill it out. But it allows you to at least document how much they're smoking, get some idea of their level of dependence, and how motivated they are to quit. So it's a brief assessment form that's included in the back of the manual. And you can see that the assessment includes things like their health conditions from smoking, their motivation. We have found, again, the things that seem to matter are the personalized feedback, so understanding the consequences that each smoker is experiencing personally from tobacco, whether those are financial consequences or health consequences, can be useful in motivating them. We also include Appendix C is a tobacco dependence treatment plan. In mental health treatment settings, there's a lot of emphasis on written formal treatment plan documents, and traditionally tobacco dependence has not been included as a problem on the treatment plan, and as you're beginning to work with clients in these settings, this can be just a useful framework to help them to start adding this to their treatment plans and give them an algorithm for the interventions that you're taking based on, again, level of dependence and motivation to change. Again, Appendix D is fairly straightforward. It's instructions for how to do a carbon monoxide reading. Some of this varies by the machine or the particular device that you're using. Appendix E is just a sample group sheet where you could record the clients that are attending group, and you might want to track their carbon monoxide levels over time, or their cigarettes per day, or their use of nicotine replacement or other tobacco treatment medications. That's typically what we have done, and that just is a sample form to help you think about that. I'm going to skip now to our evaluation study that we did on the project. As I mentioned, we implemented this with providers who had never done tobacco treatment before in outpatient settings in New Jersey. They were a combination of outpatient clinics for mental health and some partial hospital programs, which are like a day treatment center. Again, the staff really had very little prior tobacco experience. We gave them the equivalent of about a six-hour or one-day training in tobacco, so it was very limited. They were not trained in a CTTS training at the time that they used this treatment. And then we asked them to evaluate different aspects of the treatment as they began to use it with consumers in their setting. And one of the things we wanted to know was, how was the consumer interest? Were people interested in learning about this? Because remember, the bias that people often feel is that mental health consumers are not interested in addressing tobacco. And in fact, this did not indicate that. As you can see here, more than 90% of clients were interested in coming to a healthy living group. We also asked the counselors to rate participation of clients. And again, clients really participate in these groups. They participate in discussion. They ask questions. They're interested in learning the material. They say things like, why didn't anyone ever tell me before about these deadly chemicals in cigarette smoke? And they're excited to learn the new material. Another study has actually been published, and I don't know these authors personally, but learning about healthy living has now been used in many other settings and in different states. And so this was a study that this group of people did in North Carolina, where they used our Learning About Healthy Living manual in psychosocial rehab clubhouses in North Carolina, and they implemented it in 9 programs. More than 271 clients participated, and they also felt that the manual was very feasible and easy to implement and well-received by smoking clients. The staff, and this is usually what we hear, the staff were concerned at the start of the program about its viability, meaning that the staff tends to have a bias. They feel no one will come, no one will be interested, people will get up and leave group because they'll be outraged to talk about tobacco. But staff in this reported that they were surprised because they were wrong. Consumers actually really seemed to like it. And in fact, they felt that the curriculum provided a sense of camaraderie among the members of the clubhouse and generated energy because the clients wanted to do other healthy changes that they felt were a result of this initiative. So it's kind of nice and validating for us that an independent group has been using the manual with similarly positive results. So to conclude, and I'll be happy to spend the rest of the time answering questions you may have about the manual, a Learning About Healthy Living is feasible and well-received in mental health settings. We think it helps consumers in terms of addressing their readiness to change and helping them to become ready to try to stop quitting tobacco. It seems easy to implement by counselors that don't have extensive tobacco training, and we'd be happy to hear about your experiences using it in New York.
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. If you are using a speakerphone, we do ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Please hold while we wait for the first question. Our first question is from Felix Mohishka.
Yeah, right.
Felix, please state your question.
Okay. I basically didn't see, I guess, the name of the manual. I went through the presentation, but I don't know what the – I was trying to find the manual online, but I quite didn't succeed at it.
The manual is called Learning About Healthy Living, and I believe the link to the manual was available where you registered for the training, but maybe somebody else wants to say more about that.
And that has also the facilitator's guide?
Yeah, so the manual is a single PDF document, and you print, when you print it out, you'll see it's maybe 100, 150 pages, and it comes out in sequence of the entire manual. So it includes the chapters, the facilitator's guide, the handouts, all the way through the appendix. So it's all one single PDF.
Okay. All one single PDF. Good. Okay. So I should be able to sort of type in learning about healthy living, and I should be able to access it. Am I right?
Yes, but it also, they made it easier for you because the link was part of this webinar. So can someone say something about how, where the link is for a participant?
Hi, Dr. Williams. This is Pat Bax from the New York City Smokers Quit Line, the marketing coordinator.
Okay.
And I just want to thank you for such an excellent and educational presentation. And for our participants who are listening today and are looking for the manual, it is located right on our website at nysmokefree.com. And if you go to under tools on our collaborative conference call page, you'll see that it's listed right there. In addition, I just want to mention also that our conference calls are archived. So anyone who has missed our previous calls, all the call recordings and the PowerPoints and the speakers' CVs are posted. And this does include last week's call, and it will include today's call as well. It will be archived after last or after this upcoming Wednesday. Last week's call, The Role of Mental Health Professionals in Treating Tobacco Use and Dependence, is available as an archive to listen to and also the PowerPoint to access. So if you missed this call and other calls or you want to go back and review it, I do encourage you to access this information under Tools, Previous Calls, and you'll see that information there as well. For our participants, I also want to mention that if you are not familiar with the Quit Line can be an excellent resource for helping your patients become tobacco-free, and it can be an intervention strategy that you can use in the treatment planning, as Dr. Williams mentioned in her presentation, talking about treatment planning. The Quit Line can be an important strategy. And for those who may be new to our services, the Quit Line is free to all New York State residents who want to quit tobacco use. We do offer free coaching, a two-week starter kit, patches, materials, fact sheets, an online smoke-free community, and so much more. And for our providers that are on our call today, we do have our Refer to Quit program and our Opt to Quit program where you can directly refer your patients to us. So if you have information, any questions, or you need information on our services, or as Felix asked, locating the manual or any locating any of our tools today, you can call us directly at 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487, or visit our website, nysmokefree.com. So Felix, I hope that does answer your question today.
Yep. Thank you.
Our next question is from Edward Paradiso. Edward, please state your question or comment.
Actually, that was my question was exactly the same. I was trying to find out where I could find it, but then the last speaker told us where, and I was able to pick it up off the website. So thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Our next question is from Diana Raxworthy. Diana, please state your question or comment.
Yes, hello. Great presentation. One thing that I had heard before, or it seems to be something that is believed within this community, is that folks with or patients with chronic mental illness are not that, I guess I would say, receptive to worrying about the costs, or that costs of the cigarettes and the smoking are not necessarily a motivator. And you, of course, go through that, you know, that whole week's worth of group work on that. But I'm just curious if this is something that you haven't seen. Maybe it's just something that has been thought was true.
I'll do my best to answer that. I think there might be two separate issues. One of the questions I think that people ask about this group is, are they price sensitive? So when prices go up, do they stop smoking the same way that other smokers stop smoking? And I'm not sure we know the answer to that. One of the issues about price sensitivity is how addicted you are. So, for example, you might be sensitive to price, and may be some price that you feel like you would not continue smoking if cigarettes got to be some price, but that may be overshadowed by your addiction. So if you're more addicted, that might kind of counteract that price sensitivity. So it's a complicated thing. It has not been well studied how sensitive this group is to price, because what we know is that they will buy cigarettes even when the price is extremely high, and that they'll buy cigarettes in lieu of food and basic necessities. So again, if a program has initiatives for wellness, you could see how your tobacco strategies are very consistent with improving your life, because if you don't have money to buy vegetables or join a gym or do anything else to enhance your life, tobacco might be a barrier. And so I think price is a great place to go in terms of discussion. My impression has not been that people are not receptive to that discussion. And I think it's complicated by how addicted they are. But I think it's really worth discussing, and we have found it to be motivating in people. That's my personal and our group's impression.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Our next question is from Rob Hoffman. Rob, please state your question or comment.
Good morning, Dr. Williams. Thank you for your call. And I would like to say that I had the opportunity to do the training down at UMDNJ a few years ago, and if anybody has the opportunity to do that training, they should do so. It's definitely worth the time and the expenditure. My question to you today is kind of coming from my experience working with a number of different types of clinical providers, and I was asked this question once, so I wanted to kind of reframe it and give it to you so that in case it's of interest to others on the call. One time I was asked about the fact that there are basically two different approaches, I guess you could say, in terms of offering these interventions to mental health consumers. And in your manual itself, I noticed that the idea of mental health being a co-occurring situation with tobacco use is actually not mentioned in the manual at all. And one of the individuals I was working with said that he always underscores the mental health component to his patients. And yet another person in the room said, well, they may already be aware that they're a mental health consumer, so why keep droning that they're here for a smoking cessation intervention? So I was wondering if you could speak to the spirit of the differences on those two approaches and why it seems to emphasize one over the other.
Okay, I'll do my best to answer that, and thank you for endorsing our training. I mean, as you can see, the manual addresses mental illness, but it's not hitting people over the head with it. Most of the things that I showed you didn't really say a lot about having a mental health disorder, although it's interspersed. It's in there in places. I mean, I could argue that different ways. People have looked at the manual and felt that it was so light on mental illness that they could actually use it in other populations. So I get asked all the time, boy, can we use this manual in adolescents? Can we use it in substance abuse centers? And people really feel like it has a general applicability. I mean, in terms of embracing your concept as a mental health consumer, I guess I'm kind of a middle-of-the-road person. I think there's some value in kind of accepting your illness in terms of usually that means you can take steps forward for better coping and management of it that you might not be able to do if you were in complete denial. On the other hand, I do agree, yes, you know, kind of get on with it now. Don't just wear it as a flag or a badge and let it get in the way with your progress. So I would say I kind of take a moderate view about that, but I do think the manual tries to strike that balance as well, where it's not excessively preoccupied with mental illness. It's really about getting on with your life and being healthier.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Our next question is from Rochelle Ocampo. Rochelle, please state your question or comment.
Hi, this is actually Lisa Marini. And I was actually wondering if, Dr. Williams, you have experience with NRT, working with clients with serious mental illness. If you had any general advice that you could share with us about how it's different than the general population, I know that it is, but I don't know if that's going to be too big of a topic, but if you could share a few things with us.
Sure. Well, I'm a huge proponent of using NRT in this population. I've done research in that area. But I'd say a few general comments, and then if you want to ask me even a follow-up question, that would be fine. My general views are that it's grossly underutilized, and it's not uncommon for me to meet clients that tell me my psychiatrist won't prescribe, say, the patch. And so I love to get in front of audiences of psychiatrists and kind of wag my finger at them and say, it's ironic that you won't prescribe this, but it's in Target. So I think we really can't say it loud enough and repetitively enough. It's safe, it's safe, it's safe. We should be giving it to everyone. People should have much greater access to nicotine replacement, so that it's just as, you know, my colleague Jonathan Folds used to say, it should be just as easy to get nicotine as it is to get a Marlboro. And we know it's much easier to get a Marlboro in our society, which is unfortunate. So I'm a huge proponent of it. I believe it's very safe. I think in almost all patients we should be using it. That's generally my approach. So that's one aspect of my philosophy. There's a lot of data about what happens when people smoke on the patch, because that's also a huge concern in these settings. That's largely unfounded. There's quite compelling evidence now from the studies coming out of the UK that people can take NRT for years and continue to smoke and nothing bad happens to them. So, and what usually happens is that they smoke less and then some of them actually quit. So it's not that I want people to have any risk of harm, but that it actually also helps to change their behavior. So I can't say enough about how safe it is and how we should be using it more widely. The other ideas about using it in this population. So one is that we share a lot about nicotine in group. So for example, if people are encouraged to use their nicotine in group, so if somebody's craving or it's time for their dose, they might take out their inhaler or use some nicotine gum or lozenge in front of other people in the group. That's a great thing. That's modeling. Similarly, we use a lot of nasal spray. So patients might take out their nasal spray and use a dose. We want other people to get familiar with the products. We want the products to seem normal. We want to present that using these products is better than going out in the snow and smoking. Lots of things to kind of say this is healthier coping and reinforcing use of the medicine. When someone comes to our groups new and they don't have a lot of experience using nicotine, it's fun when the other members start to tell them about the experiences and about the different products, and they can say, you know, I tried this, I didn't like that one, Dr. Williams should give you a prescription for this one. So we make it very much part of the group activity and the discussion and try to model the behavior in terms of using nicotine. And then finally, the last thing that I would say, one thing that we do that might be slightly different than other settings is we do try to kind of look at people's patches. So when people are wearing the patch, we might not do it in the group. We might do it privately. But it's always a good idea just to take that quick peek at the patch, see if there's skin irritation. You know, I've had people not take the liner off the back, so maybe they're not using it exactly right. We've had people leave two on by accident. You learn a lot by looking at people. And sometimes there's opportunities there for education. I don't know if you have a specific follow-up question to that.
No, I just wanted to generally ask about the usage and get your general opinion, and that's very helpful. I think probably it's similar. I don't know if you agree with this, to what you're talking about with the counseling, that you have to take a slower approach and really make sure they understand how to properly use. I know the general population tends to not use it correctly, so I would imagine that's perhaps more happens even more with this population.
Yes. I would say yes, we do more education. In fact, there's been times when it's usually part of a study, although anybody could do this. We take out the package insert. If you've ever seen, like, the insert for the lozenge, it's so tiny, no one could ever read it. And sometimes we've taken that and actually just retyped it or copied it in, like, 14 font and given it out to people as a handout so they could actually read it and have the information. So sometimes we just try and disseminate the information in a more useful way, in addition to going over it verbally. And sometimes we have done that with by making handouts, so that's something we have also done. But I don't know that necessarily means that we go slower, because, again, I want to use nicotine aggressively, so that may or may not mean that I use it slower, although I definitely use it with a longer psychoed. So I might spend more minutes for the first psychoed, and I might keep doing psychoed at every visit to make sure that they're doing it correctly, but that doesn't always mean that I delay or that I use it in a slower way, just to clarify that.
Thank you. I found that very helpful. Appreciate it.
Our next question is from Paul Ferrari. Paul, please state your question or comment.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Williams. What's your experience with prescribers being bought into the whole stages of change, working with individuals with severe mental illness? In some cases, many of them also have a co-occurring serious substance abuse disorder with the whole stages of change model. And then they're taking the time to address smoking dependence once they've formulated a quit date.
You know, I think in some ways, and I think nowadays everybody knows stages of change, and I think in some ways these providers are quite good at understanding it and using it correctly, because when you think about co-occurring disorders, mental health has changed quite a bit in that we mostly now embrace that we have to treat addiction. You know, there's only one client, and so we have to treat their addiction if we're seeing them for mental health. We that's part of the package. And similarly, as part of that paradigm, sometimes the people don't want to give up substances. So we no longer say to people, well, go away and come back when you're ready to be sober. We know that's not the best approach. And so we treat people with mental illness, even though they may have some ongoing substance use, and we work with them over time to help them to change that behavior, so the goal is eventual abstinence. And I think that's a way that providers use the stages of change correctly and in a way that helps clients. What's funny to me and the paradox is that somehow people think of tobacco as in a different box. So I wish that people would just do the same old thing with tobacco that they do with other substances and integrate it into what they do and take a long-term approach. Instead, people say, oh, he doesn't want to quit, so therefore I have nothing to do. And so it's inconsistent sometimes with the way that they do all the rest of their work, and we need to undo that. We need to help people understand, you know, addressing tobacco is the same argument, it's the same discussion, it's the same therapeutic approach as taking your medication, it's the same approach as not drinking alcohol, and so if people would just buy into that, I think people would do a lot more tobacco work.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Our next question is from Patricia Briest. Patricia, please state your question or comment.
Our folks here actually have two questions, so I'm going to pass the phone. No, I'll ask the first question. Some of our mental health patients are turning to the electronic cigarettes as an alternative. How are you addressing that in your program?
Well, in all honesty, we're not really, and it's unfortunate. We're trying to educate people that, you know, with the same limited information that everybody else has, that we don't know that they're safe, that we don't recommend it, and that we try to steer people towards evidence-based treatments. So, unfortunately, everybody's kind of at a loss right now until we have more research, and we're trying to tell people don't waste your money, especially when you can get access to free evidence-based treatments.
Thank you, Doctor. Our second question involves the distribution of nicotine replacement products to your patients. Do you find it best that they have a traditional 2-week supply, or do you give it on a daily basis?
Oh, no, we would never give it on a daily basis. So, for example, if I was using nasal spray or inhaler with someone, they would get monthly prescriptions. The other products we know come in about a 2-week supply per box, so we don't change that in any way.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Ruth Puckahaber. Ruth, please state your question or comment.
It's Ruth Puckahaber. I actually work in a PROS outpatient setting program. And I've been using the manual for probably the last 2 years or so. I started having two groups, one pretty much single to the group number one, which was the healthy living approach. And that kind of dwindled, and some of those folks, I kind of referred them into the second group on healthy living. And the participants in that group currently, there's kind of a combination. A couple of the clients are or have actually quit smoking, and they actually are a lot of help to those that are still struggling. So my current group is actually they're all still smoking, so I'm doing a lot of work in harm reduction and using kind of motivational interviewing to kind of work them towards that balance in terms of where they're at in terms of their decision to move a little bit closer, and a lot of work on barriers that's actually preventing them from kind of moving forward. So I really didn't have a question, but if Dr. Williams has anything she might want to add, I'd appreciate that.
I'm curious, what have you learned in terms of the barriers that they identify?
The fact that there are a lot of them, one of the main barriers is that they actually, it's a fear-based barrier, that their actual mental health symptoms will increase if they continue to reduce their smoking. So I spend a lot of time in helping them learn strategies to deal or to cope with stress. So I'm kind of at a standstill, but I just continue to act as an encourager, letting them know that their decision to quit, it's a process rather than an event in and of itself. So, but that's their major fear, that they won't be able to manage their mental health symptoms because they so closely mimic some of the withdrawal symptoms.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I think you're doing great work. I think that the risk, though, in reduction is that it's a double-edged sword.
No.
And it's possible that these people are having withdrawal. And so, you know, I'm always very conflicted about reduction because I like to tell patients I don't want them to suffer at all. I'm the no-suffer doctor. So I'm much more likely to slap patches on people even when they're ambivalent rather than see them experience withdrawal and give up. So I think if you're helping people reduce and they're not sure they want to quit, it might be the time to add NRT because they're having withdrawal, and that might even get them the rest of the way. They might be so much more comfortable that it actually increases their self-efficacy, their sense that they could succeed. So you might want to use more medicine if that hasn't been a part of your approach.
Well, currently it isn't, because our physicians that are in the outpatient setting, they make most of the referrals for anyone who needs a, you know, kind of assistance through an NRT. They actually do most of the referral to the person's primary care physicians.
Well, they
so
should be ashamed of themselves.
Our psychiatrists are not ordering anything.
Unless they send those same clients to primary care for cocaine dependence, they should be ashamed of themselves because they...
Yeah, it's kind of like you're preaching to the choir here.
They probably treat those clients other addiction, and you should leave papers that I wrote that say psychiatrists ought to belly up and do this under their door, because it really needs to change.
Yeah. Well, that's a good suggestion. I will begin to do that. Thank you very much.
I mean, I could go on for half an hour why it's so the wrong thing to send people to primary care. There's barriers. It might take 6 months to get them in there. The doctor is going to have 3 minutes with them, so they're not going to get the psychoed. The doc's right there. He's part of the team, the psychiatrist. He should be helping you, not a barrier. I can give you 100 reasons why he's wrong.
Yeah, oh, I'm in total agreement. That's just kind of like one of the obstacles that we face here, you know, based on outpatient mental health, you know, and they really kind of stick to their med service visits, evaluating their psychotropic medications. So,
can you go to the administrators of those programs and just have meetings to discuss it, and just to say, you know, you think it would be better for your clients to not have to do that because of the time and resources and blah blah blah, and maybe get their buy-in that something that they want to see happen. Certainly, I know. At the state level through OMH, they want to see it happen. So these people's supervisors at the top want to see this happen. So I think that there's some support, although I don't know if you feel it locally.
Yeah, I could have a discussion with the medical director. He's pretty good about introducing some of these, you know, kind of state-of-the-art, and in terms of involving, you know, the psychiatrist in an active approach to, you know, treating co-occurring, and certainly tobacco use is considered a co-occurring disorder.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so very much.
Our next question is from Helene Benjamin. Helene, please state your question or comment.
That nicotine, you know, speeds up the metabolism. So when people are off patches and they're stopped smoking, that the medic, whatever meds they are, may stay in the system. Is that accurate with psychiatric meds too, that they might need an adjustment?
Yeah, so they'll remember it has nothing to do with nicotine.
Oh.
The interaction is coming from smoke.
Uh-huh.
Smoke interacts with psychiatric medication. Not all of them, but there's a list of them. And it's not nicotine. So the patch and the gum have nothing to do with this. Smoke interacts with medicine. So it is true that when some people with psychiatric illnesses quit smoking, sometimes they can take less of these medications that were impacted by smoking.
Okay, thank you. So they might need an adjustment.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question is from Amy Lynn Karnbach. Amy, please state your question or comment.
Good morning. Thank you for a good presentation. It's really helpful information. I'm wondering about follow-up. Would you recommend a six-month follow-up to see how successful folks have remained abstinent, or 1 year? What would you recommend?
Well, I guess it depends on where you are and what you're able to do and what you want to know that for. You know, these are people that we often see in an ongoing way because we see them in the clinic or we continue treatment with them. But typically tobacco programs do a 6-month follow-up, maybe even over the phone if you can't do it in person. So I think that's the standard. That would be perfectly acceptable to do a 6-month follow-up.
Okay, thank you for your help.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Our next question is from Debbie Keith. Debbie, please state your question or comment.
Good morning, Jill. Thank you for a wonderful presentation. I just heard you mention that, you know, we could slip under the psychiatrist's doors reasons why they should administer nicotine replacement therapy. I would love to read those papers because it is a huge obstacle, and I would love to be able to take from your experience to make sure that it is implemented in a kind way to these psychiatrists, if you will.
I'll be happy to send one or two PDFs to Margo, and she can distribute them to the group. That's fine. And certainly that's why we have training in New Jersey twice a year. We're always trying to target psychiatrists. We recognize that it's not part of training. So I didn't learn about tobacco through my traditional training. There's just a big void that psychiatrists don't learn about tobacco. And so we have a CME education where people come and spend 2 days and kind of get immersed in this and up to speed. But there's not a whole lot of other educational opportunities. So we do have to be somewhat sympathetic that this has not been the traditional role, although we have to work to change it.
Absolutely, but it is a huge obstacle, whereas the majority want them to go see their general practitioner. And I agree wholeheartedly. It's a time-consuming effort, and, you know, folks with severe mental illness are the same as any other consumer. When they get to the point with this education, such as your healthy living, they get to the point that, you know, they're ready to contemplate quitting. We need to strike right then and there and get them on the medication, not wait 6 months for an appointment, whereas our window is completely closed then.
I agree. The only thing I would say is that the leadership in New York is working towards this, so maybe these providers will hear more about that in the future.
I hope so. Thank you.
Our next question is from Madeline Nolan. Madeline, please state your question or comment.
My question is, does the approach to treatment change if the client is pregnant?
Oh, well, that's a tough question. I always say, you know, I'm just a simple psychiatrist. And I'm not an expert on pregnancy. There's really a whole approach for pregnancy. You know, most people feel that you can give nicotine medicine safely in pregnancy, although you tend to go low and slow as opposed to giving it aggressively like we do for other conditions. So I think I'm going to stop with that and say it's not really my area of expertise.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question is from Patricia Brees. Patricia, please state your question or comment.
Our group is wondering about the recidivism rate with this population. We know it's fairly high in the typical population, but is this something that you see more success with the groups that you're talking about?
Well, overall, the quit rates for this group are low. Most studies have shown maybe half as successful as other smokers. So if you might get a 30% success rate with a given approach in smokers, it may only be 15% in this group. They're only half as successful. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, and I wouldn't say that this approach is stronger than other approaches, but it probably means that people need longer-term help, more of a chronic disease model so that they can keep engaging back into treatment and trying again, so it probably will take them more attempts.
I Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad.
Amanda, this is Pat Bax from the New York State Smokers Quit Line. I just wanted to mention we had a question earlier about e-cigarettes, and recently we posted on the Quit site at nysmokefree.com under the resource section. If you click on the resource section and there's fact sheets to download, we do now have a fact sheet specifically on the e-cigarettes. It's under the general information section, and it's entitled E-Cigarettes Know the Facts. And there's some citations there for reading more information on the research associated with e-cigarettes. So that may be a helpful fact sheet for our listeners today.
Our next question is from Rochelle Alcampo. Rochelle, please state your question or comment.
Hi. I actually did think of a follow-up question about the NRT. In particular, I was wondering your feelings about Chantix, given recent changes with that and bupropion, and if you could comment on that.
I'm also a believer in Chantix, so I actually wrote a review paper about Chantix and reviewed the case report data on adverse events. The biggest difficulty with Chantix right now is certainly we have to err on the side of safety, and we have to be concerned about these potential neuropsychiatric side effects. But the inconsistency out there right now is that many, many studies have been done that don't show it. And the only evidence that we have for the neuropsychiatric side effects are from single case studies, like what happened to one person. And usually in science, we don't pay a lot of attention to those. We say, you know what, those are idiosyncratic. And we only really know if something is true if we see it happening in a study of 5,000 patients. And for the most part, we have not seen those side effects in the studies. So there is disagreement there between the cases and the research. And, I can't help but I think like a researcher, so I believe the research data that shows there's not a whole lot there. We've used it in practice. We've also been part of Pfizer clinical studies where we've used it in patients. In fact, we were in the schizophrenia study, which hopefully will be published soon, and was, fairly positive study. And lots of patients quit smoking in that study. So I'm fairly positive about it, and I would, in talking to a patient, I would say these are the options. I would explain each of them, and I would say, you should really choose the one that you want. But I don't slant it one way or another.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. It appears we have no further questions at this time.
Thank you, Amanda. This is Ann Wendland again with the Tobacco Control Program, and thank you, Dr. Williams, and everybody for their questions. That was very insightful. I want to remind everyone that our third and final call in the Addressing Tobacco Dependence and Recovery for Persons with Mental Illness series will be next Wednesday, February 15th. Please note that the start time for that call will be 12 p.m. And all of the materials for that call will be on the registration site, just as they were for today. On February 15th, Tara Fredericks from the Clubhouse of Suffolk will continue our discussion on approaches for treating tobacco use in the mental health setting. She's also going to discuss implementing tobacco dependence treatment programming, including a peer program in her agency. So on behalf of New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program, New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to express our sincere appreciation for the excellent presentation today, and thanks to all of you who participated in the call. This brings us to the end of our call. Thank you again, and have a great day. Take care.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation, and all participants may now disconnect their lines.